Shalom Aleichem, Chavrut, V'yamin Hammer here at the National Council of Young Israel. We welcome Rebbe and all other Rabbanim on the call for conference call number 81. Thank you, Rebbe.
Thank you very much. Question one. At what age should girls no longer daven with their fathers in the men's section? B. Does it make any difference if the girl is afraid to sit in the women's section by herself? C. Is there any inyan of chinuch to take girls to shul for davening? There's no specific age cutoff. Depends on the girl, both in terms of her body and soul. It depends on the ambiance in the particular shul. As a rule, the girl herself will be embarrassed to sit in the men's section on her own from a certain age, and we'll go into the ladies' section. Of course, depends upon her friends, as most things do with young girls. I think that when a girl begins school, first grade, it's preferred that she not be anymore in the men's section. Some will already go out earlier than that. That's approximately the age of 6 years old. Of course, from that point and on, they're usually able to read a little bit, so they're able to be themselves in the ladies' section. If she's afraid, we should calm her down, and preferably we should find an older girl or older woman who will take responsibility for her to sit near her, assuming her mother's not there. There certainly is an inyan of chinuch for a girl to daven, even to daven with a tzibur. In many shuls, they have youth groups during the davening, where they learn, they daven, and they have something to eat, and they sing, which can be a very positive chinuch experience. For girls, it's even a little bit easier. Boys run around more and make more trouble. So it's certainly a positive experience for girls to be in shul, as long as they're supervised properly. When they're very young and they want to sit next to their father, that's certainly acceptable, as long as the people in the shul will feel comfortable. In some shuls, they're much more strict. They don't girls of any age into the men's section. That's a question of sensitivity, which, of course, should be respected. Question two. Discuss the issue of Shabbos makeup. Cosmetics that are made out of some kind of powder that lasts for a short or long while. Is there a concern for Maris Iron that someone may use the product but not follow the instructions and potentially be Mechal Shabbos? This is quite a long-standing issue. Shabbos makeup, someone calls Shabbat, and they claim that they last only for a short time. My experience, I was given certain of these products, is not that way. They last for much longer than advertised. And Talmud recently gave me a product. A new product is supposed to be short-lived and good. I found it had residue even 24 hours later. It's very difficult to be matter these types of makeup. There is a tshuva of Moshe. He talks about things like talcum powder, things of that nature. These products are being sold, from what I could see, were not comparable. There are those Rabbanim who think they are, and they rely on Rav Moshe's Shuva in these cases as well, and you know, they're entitled to their opinion. I'm also aware of the fact that many women, even from women, are making themselves up on Shabbos. It's not right. According to most authorities, they shouldn't do it. At the same time, according to most authorities, it's a rabbinic prohibition. It's not soveya on a doraisa level. And some might say mutam shushogos vayu mezidos. It depends on every particular case. The proper way to do it, if they want to have makeup, is to put on the makeup from before Shabbos. And they have certain kinds of products which last for a long time. I remember, over 30 years ago, they started lipstick, which lasts for, put it on before Shabbos, it can last you into Shabbos afternoon. and there may be even certain makeup products which also last for a long time. And I don't believe there's any marathon in that kind of a case, because it's well known that this exists, and hopefully they'll give you the benefit of the doubt that you did it from before Shabbos, and they will not learn from you to do it on Shabbos. Once again, this is a sensitive issue. I know that there are many women who are, how should we say, Shomer Shabbos in general, but for some reason they're relying on leniencies, whether it be the Shabbat makeup or even lipstick, which has other issues, and other kinds of makeup products. It is a very serious problem for the halacha. But once again, it's most likely the Rabbanon, and in some situations, you have to consider the Mutiv Shushogos option, as we find in other areas of Shabbos and Tosus and in the Shulchan Aruch. Every case is a little bit different. 3, what should the position of the Rav be on the shul board, if any? Should he be the chairman, CEO of the board, or should he be on the religious committee, or is it better for the Rav to not be on the board at all? B, should he attend the meetings? What about general membership meetings? Maybe his presence will stifle people from expressing what they want or need. This clearly is a case-by-case question. Depends on who the Rav is, depends on who the shul is. It's impossible to give one answer to fit all. I can only speak for myself. In my own shul, where I've been the Rav now, going on 46 years, B'liyan Hara, we don't have a religious committee. I think it's a mistake. The rabbi has a religious committee. He's the one that's supposed to decide all the religious issues. If they have questions, they should come to the Rav to decide what to do. I've never been at a membership meeting or a board meeting, and I believe that that's the proper way to do it. However, I understand that in some circumstances it cannot be done. But if you ask what should, so I think that's the should when possible. Question 4. While duchening, should a Kohen have his hands together, creating a triangle of sorts between his two hands, or just hold them up at shoulder height, outstretched in front of him, but not together? This is found in Shulchan Aruch. It's in Kuf Chof Ches Sif Yud Beis. It's clear the Shulchan Aruch's preference. There are 5 avirim, which means that the Kohen holds his two hands ideally at shoulder height, the right a tad above the left, so that the right thumb is just above the left thumb. And where are the 5 spaces between, in each hand, between the 2 smaller fingers and the 2 bigger fingers, between the pinky and the ring finger on one hand, and then the middle finger and the index finger on the other. There's a hole between them. Another hole between the index finger and the thumb. And another hole between the 2 thumbs, even though they're touching each other, but beneath them is a hole. That's what's called the 5 avirim, or spaces between the fingers of the Kohen, with the right above the left, I mean, just touching it on top. This is something which I don't look at. It's a minute not to look at the Kohen when they're duchen. I'm just telling you, since I'm not a Kohen, what it says in the Shulchan Aruch, and my presumption is that the Kohanim are doing it in that fashion, even though there may be other manners which are described in other different sfar. 5, if a shul has no duchen, raised platform in front of the aron, do I need to put down a tablecloth or a piece of plastic cardboard for corners to stand on so that they are raised up? I don't believe that it achieves raising up. This is a plastic or cardboard. And it's not ma'akev. In our shul, for all the years, we didn't have one. Just now the shul was redone. They say you go up 2 little steps to the duchen where the aron kodesh is. But for all the years, we did not have one, and many yeshivas and shuls and batei medrash do not have. It's not ma'akev, and I would not recommend trying to achieve it with a piece of plastic or cardboard. 6, if a single woman owns a house and wants to rent out the basement to a single man, is there any way for her to do so that would avoid yichud? Would it help if he had a separate entrance, and the only door from the basement to the rest of the house is locked on both sides? Does it make a difference if the rental is long-term or for a few nights? Clearly, there's a serious yichud problem for one man and one woman. But on the other hand, it's also clear that if there are 2 apartments in an apartment building, which are near each other, there's no problem whatsoever. Here, the question is the fact that there is a door between the two parts of the house. Seems to me, if the door is kept locked on both sides at all times, then it's in effect two separate apartments, like two separate houses. The fact that there happens to be a door there is of no consequence as long as it is kept locked on both sides at all times. Anything short of that would be a serious problem. So that's the only way to do it in this particular circumstance. 7. May one tour the Vatican City? If yes, is it all permitted or only certain parts? It's clear that one may not enter into a church, and the Vatican City has many churches. Sistine Chapel is a famous church, which is still being used to my knowledge. On the other hand, the museums are not churches, and many great rabbis have gone into the museums for various manuscripts. So the short answer is museums, as a rule, are okay, and churches are off limits. 8. If one pays his non-Jewish secretary by the hour and there is no stipulation on the amount of hours she must work, can the non-Jewish employee take work home over the weekend and decide for herself to do it on Shabbos and not on Sunday? Would it constitute adata d'nafshe? Can we view them as the mala of a kavlan versus a shriyom? The answer is yes. The person takes work home. You're not telling her when to work. She decides to do it on Shabbos, not on Sunday. That's totally her own decision, and there's no problem if it's done. 9. Once heard the Rav state that the master is calculating one's bills are paid on a discretionary income. Is this accurate? If yes, if someone, lo aleinu, really has no money left after paying bills, how is master stock in general calculated? What may have been heard is as follows, that if someone has no money left after paying bills, they're exempt from master. Let's remember, the master is not an absolute obligation. It's considered to be a minhag tov, which should be followed when possible and appropriate. But if one has discretionary income, then the master is not calculated based on discretionary income alone. No, the master is calculated based on the total income. So, for example, someone makes $100,000 a year and needs $100,000 to live. So he's putter from Meiser. You have to pay all your bills first. Give a little stock. Everyone has to give a little bit of stock, but you're putter from Meiser. Let's say a person needs $100,000 to live, but he makes $120,000 a year. Then, to fulfill the mitzvah, you have to give $12,000 of master, which is one-tenth of the 120, leaving you 8 for disposable income, as opposed to, the question seems to imply, you'd only give 2,000 out of the 20. So to repeat, if you have no disposable income, you're putter completely. If you have disposable income, you should, if possible, give 10% of the sum total, as long as you are left with your expenses to be able to pay for your bills. Question 10. May one borrow money with interest from a credit union? What about if he doesn't know if the rov are akum? The answer is, as spoken about in previous conference calls, that we assume that credit unions are permissible if they are in fact owned the majority by non-Jews. It's up to the person in dealing with the credit union to make sure that the majority is not Jewish. 11. A woman received a popular Abigam Leal coin from Eretz Yisrael. She would like to wear it as a necklace to serve as an amulet. May she wear it on Shabbos, or is it Hotzah? If yes, may she wear it under her blouse, being that it's not really nice jewelry and she wears it during the week under her shirt. I believe that this, I know nothing about amulets, Abigam Leal, I don't know what it means, but I believe it has the status of Kamiya She'ena Mumcha, which means we're not sure it really works. We won't say for sure it doesn't work. The Mishnah Berurah writes in Siman Shin Ches Sitkat and Kuf Chav Tes, it's permissible in a carmelis, not in a Rishus Rabban Daraisa, only according to our custom found in Siman Shin Gimel Sifyut Ches, which tells us that women wear jewelry despite the prohibitions, rabbinical prohibitions in the Gemara, and one of the reasons there is Mutav Shushol Gusayim Matidos. There are other reasons given there as well. So most authorities maintain that our Rosh Hashanah is only a carmelis for a variety of reasons. And therefore, according to this logic of the Mishnah Berurah, it would be okay for her to wear this kamiya she'ena mumche, and it was just the rabbanon and the carmelists, which is what our present circumstances are, according to most authorities. It is true that the Mishnah Berurah that quotes, if you do a she'ena mumche, vaday, if you know for sure it doesn't work, then it's prohibited, even in the carmelists. But clearly this woman thinks that it works, and who am I to say it doesn't? I don't know what Rabbi Gamliel coin means, but if we can't prove definitively it doesn't work, then it would be permissible in the carmelists. And according to most authorities, our Shas Rabbans have a status of carmelists, as the Mishnah Berurah explains. 12. Can a woman put in an IUD in the morning after going to the mikveh, or is it like the morning after pill that is considered abortion? It's clear that the IUD is considered the same as the morning after pill. And what it does in both cases, it prevents implantation. The morning after, if there was a beginning of a pregnancy, there are a few cells which are somehow still swimming in the fallopian tubes, haven't entered into the uterus yet, and by either the morning after pill or by the IUD, you can prevent implantation. In both cases, there was a possibility of a violation of abortion, even though the cells are only in the fallopian tubes, because they have the potential to swim out into the uterus, attach, implant in the walls, and become a baby. So it's really a serious problem. It's not the same as an IUD which was put in advance, that's there before the couple's together. Then there were no cells that ever had a chance of being viable. Although there was a conception, there were some rabbis who prohibited IUDs in general because they considered every month an abortion, that's not the halakha consensus. We assume if the IUD is there in advance, nothing was ever viable, and therefore it's not considered to be an abortion. But in this case, the IUD put it in the morning after, in effect, is a greater halachic problem. There may be certain rabbanim who will be making the Shas HaTchak Gadol, but the questioner wants to know, is it like the morning after pill? The answer is yes. 13. If one is married for many years and his wife lost a ksuba, and he will not be able to have a ksuba the irkusa, that's what the next word should say. When his ksuba gets lost, he's supposed to get a new one. Until a few days later, priests provide the proper kinyonim and the amount necessary for allow them to live together. B, can we say that since it's a chemer ben gershom that he cannot divorce his wife against her will, he may stay without a ksuba? Now, B is discussed in the Ramah, and Evan Ezer, Simon Samach Vav Sivbeis, he quotes such a logical view that the only reason for a ksuba is to take halabain of lotzia, he cannot divorce her against her will, but today it cannot be done because of Rabbi Negerishon's chayrim. Perhaps the ksuba is not as necessary as it used to be. Notwithstanding that line in Ramah, we still have a custom to be makbid on a ksuba, obviously at the wedding and even beyond if it gets lost. But it is an additional consideration. The fact that the court of our mother's room to be lenient nowadays for Ashkenazim who do not allow a ksuba against her will, the reason for the ksuba may not apply. That same din in Shulchan Aruch, Sif, Simuch, Samuch, Rav, Sif, Beis, discusses what do you do about a case where there is no ksuba right now. So first of all, today's world, it's hard to understand why I can't get a ksuba d'irchusa until a few days later. We live in a world of internet, email, and scanning, and so many ways to get a ksuba form. Maybe the question means there are no kosher eidim who would sign the ksuba d'irchusa. That's a rarity, but may happen. But in most cases, you don't have it. You have it sent to you electronically one way or the other and fill it out right away. All you need is a rub to tell you how to fill it out. This can be either in person or on the phone. Two kosher witnesses to sign it, and you're done. That should be done on the same day if it's discovered that the ksuba is lost. What if it's impossible for whatever reason? Kinyanim, you already have kinyanim. The kinyanim were made at the time of the chuppah. But now the ksuba is lost, and we're afraid she doesn't have the security. You know, he really owes her the money. She lacks the security, and she's afraid that since he doesn't have a piece of paper, bikal bein avotziah. So in the Shulchan Aruch, in that same Simon Samuel, same Siv Beis, a discussion exists. If you can't have a piece of paper, in a Shas HaTzchak case, you can give the wife an object of value, worth the value of the ksuba that she holds on to for security, and on a temporary basis, this can suffice. What is the ksuba worth? So a ksuba these days consists of three parts. The ksuba itself, then the dunya and the tosefes. The dunya and tosefes is worth a lot of money, but that's not our topic for right now. The Messiah Zuz of the ksuba itself is worth much less money. It's a matter of fact, it's 10 times the pinyon of hen. The latest calculation of the price of silver, the entire ksuba, the eco ksuba, is worth in the range of $540. And therefore, if a man has an item of value which is worth that amount of money or more, he gives it to his wife. That's her security. You can think that most houses will have something worth that amount. Or if you have a few items, you have laptops and cell phones and other kinds of things which perhaps, technically speaking, belong to the husband, and he can just give them to his wife to hold on to and under her control. There may be other such items as well. But that's a shatat chak. It's preferable to get the ksuba d'irchus signed immediately. Question number 14. A congregant purchased a summer home and recently closed on the mortgage. The first thing he'll be living in it is next spring before Pesach. Although no one will be living in it, he'd like to furnish it over the winter. When is he obligated to put up a mezuzah? Only when he lives in it. As a rule, living in it means when you sleep there with your family the first night, that's when you live in it. Until next spring before Pesach, even though he is furnishing it, and even though a beis ha'otzer, if some type of a space is used just to store things, you may be chayav, that's what we paskin, but if it's primarily used for living in and now you're just storing things there, that would not qualify. And therefore, I don't believe it's an obligation until the next spring. Question number 15. What is the halachic, if asked more appropriately, hashkafic approach towards shopping in Aldi, a German-founded and owned supermarket chain? This is a very sensitive question. There are many individuals who would not buy German-made products, such as cars, furniture, etc. My mother, Aleha Shalom, would never buy anything from Germany. The Germans killed her sisters and brother and their spouses and their children. She would never allow anything German into the house. And I believe this is a significant custom among Holocaust survivors' families, and many of us are certainly in that category, though things have sort of softened in the last year since the Holocaust is over. There are those who say that the German people is Amalek. There's one source is Germania, another source is the Vilna Gaon's interpretation of the Hashmid, the Arag, or the Abed, the three things that the Abbe meant to destroy the bodies, which is what the Germans did in the crematoria. There are those who feel this way. My Rebbe at one point was upset when they wanted to take reparations money from the German government. He felt it was money from Amalek. The question is, nowadays, if somebody has passed, do these restrictions still apply? That's a more hashkafic than halachic, as the questioner understood. It's also an emotional piece. As the generations go on, that sensitivity seems to be abating. In any event, one can make a distinction between buying an object which was made in Germany, which is more of a problem, as to buying groceries in a store that happens to be owned by a German family. It's not the same thing. You'd be eating the same Cheerios as you would otherwise, just a few pennies going to go in profit to a family which is German. That's a much less of a problem, if you ask me. But again, people have to make their own decisions based primarily on their hashkafa and their sensitivities. Question 16. Realizing it's not a quick fix or one size fits all, please provide some suggestions that reduce / eliminate talking during laning / davening. Are there different suggestions for people that barely read Hebrew? How does one respectfully and effectively communicate to the Gaboyim that the quote Gabay meeting during Chazaras HaShatz is wrong and a negative influence on the shul atmosphere. Well, the rabbi has to tell these individuals straight up, this is absolutely unacceptable. Unacceptable. Gaboyim should meet during Chazaras HaShatz. The Gaboyim is supposed to be in charge of keeping the shul quiet, not of talking during Chazaras HaShatz. This is a problem which we call a Makas Medina, unfortunately. It's all over the place, talking in shul. And I believe it's the Rav's responsibility to emphasize time and time again that one may not speak during these periods of time. Let's take Chazaras HaShatz, for example. In Siman Kuf Chav Dalet Siv Zayin, Shulchan Aruch has very fiery words to say about someone who speaks during Chazaras HaShatz, it's Gadol Avonam in the Soul. It's a terrible thing. It's supposed to scold him. Of course, in today's world, scolding doesn't go too far. With some sensitivity, though, you have to say it straight up. Straight up. I've said it so many times, obviously I haven't succeeded because the need to say it again and again and again indicates my failure, but does not allow me to stop trying. The Mishnah Berurah writes there in Sivkot Chav Zayin, unfortunately, Kamebot Eknesios Necheru Bishvil Avonze, shuls were destroyed because of the sin of talking during davening, which may not be done. Nowadays, in our country, I've said it many times in my shul over the years, the shul can be destroyed because the neighborhood can change. I live in the Bronx. There are untold numbers of shuls all over the Bronx, which are now, unfortunately, no longer shuls, and even more unfortunately, too many of them are churches, which is a tragedy. And according to this Mishnah Berurah, maybe the reason was because people talking in shul. I tell my balabata, if you want to preserve your real estate value of your homes, better not talk in shul. More recently, people asked Reb Chaim Kanievsky about the attacks in various shuls in the United States of America by security measures, etc. He said the most important security measure is don't talk in shul. If you don't talk in shul, you will be protected. This is not to discuss other means of protection, but I tell balabata, if you're talking in shul, you present a security risk, according to Reb Chaim Kanievsky, and therefore please cease and desist. I try very hard. The Mishnah Berurah there said you should appoint special people, anoshim, miyuchadim lashgiach al zeh. Some might call them ushers, some might call them gaboyim, but the gaboyim themselves have to certainly be quiet during Chazaras HaShatz. You have to have the gaboyim meeting either before davening or after Chazaras HaShatz, in those few minutes, if the Kaddish Shiskabel is over before they actually make a decision to give aliyah to. If they haven't done it earlier, which they should confer later, not during Chazaras HaShatz. If someone cannot read, they should daven in English. During Kriyas HaTorah, they should read from an English Chumash, cite the English Chumash. That's the best they can do. Otherwise, they go crazy. They can't read Hebrew in the shul. How are they going to spend their time properly on davening? So that's the proper way to with English. Recently, over the Yom Narayim season, I spoke to my balabatim. I asked him to make a Kabbalah. The shul was rededicated, a new space, a nicer space. I said, there are four points in time when people speak. I'm not discussing when it's absolutely prohibited without any questions. There are people who speak during Pesukah de Zimra or Birchas Kriyashma, their own Shemona Esrei, that's absolutely prohibited. And thank God in my shul, that doesn't exist. But there were four sensitive time periods. One is Chazaras HaShatz, which we just spoke about. I quoted you chapter and verse from the Mechaber, from the Shulchan Aruch. There were three other times. One was after a person finishes his private Shemona Esrei, before the chazan even starts Chazaras HaShatz. People sometimes get fidgety and they start talking to each other, which is terrible. And I said, what you should have in your pocket or your shtend or your table is a pocket little sefer, whether it be Chumash and Rashi, whether it be Mishnayos. And when you have to wait till the Rav finishes, that's what you should do. And you'd be surprised how much you can cover in a minute here and 2 minutes there. In that period of time, instead of talking to others, which is very disruptive and for those who are still saying Shemona Esrei, take out a little safer and learn from it. I also spoke about Kaddish. People speak during Kaddish is also not supposed to be done. It's a very serious problem. And the final issue, maybe the most sensitive, is Ben Gavra Le Gavra. Now, the questioner asked about talking during davening and laning. Thankfully, in many shuls, I think my shul is included, people are not talking actually while the Balkori is laning the main part of the Aliyah. But sometimes they start talking about Ben Gavra Le Gavra, they get carried away, and they don't stop on the dime. That's one of the reasons that Mr. Ruth, you should not speak at all Ben Gavra Le Gavra, because you may not stop on the dime. So I asked people to make small kabbalas, to take one or more of those four periods of time and make a decision not to talk. Just say nothing. It's hard to control others speak to you. So you have to answer them, they are covered. There's some truth to that. But it's a lack of cover to the entire tzibur when you answer back, especially if it's audible. People who talk inappropriately during these four periods of time should be just said, nodded at. You know, I can't talk to you now. I'll talk to you afterwards. This is something which is important. There's another way that they attempt to stop talking in shul, having a kiddush after shul. Kiddush after shul, so those who want to say something to somebody else could wait till after shul and be a little bit patient and talk then. This is certainly a good idea if the logistics work out. It's very, very important that the shuls be quiet. Another suggestion is to streamline the davening. If it takes too long, people just get restless. That's another important idea. No need to stretch the davening out. You don't have to daven so quickly, but a lot of time is downtime to try to eliminate that as much as possible. These are all strategies. You're right, it's not a quick fix, it's not a one-size-fits-all, but these attempts have to be made to have a more quiet and appropriate shul during davening. Question number 17. I'd like to invite my high school class to come to my house for a Chanukah Mesiyah, but the best time to arrange this practically is immediately after school. It ends at 6 p.m. Some boys live locally, and some are further away. What should I tell my students to do about lighting? Have someone light for them, or light later themselves, or some other advice? It's a very good question. Seems to me that the best way is that the youngsters should light when they get home. Ideally, they should appoint an agent, a shaliach, to remind them to light when they get home. They shouldn't forget, because there's a problem of eating before the Hadlakas HaNeiros. A shaliach would help. Today, these days, you can also remind yourself on your cell phone, on your WhatsApp. There are many other ways to have reminders that you won't forget to light later on. This, I believe, is the proper thing to do. In particular, in a situation in which the Baal HaBayis, the father of these Talmidim, was home by 6 o'clock, and he lit, because if that's the case, then it seems to me that the Talmidim and the yeshiva had already discharged their obligation to their father. All that's left for them to do is what we call Mahadrin. Nerishu Beis, and Mahadrin Ner, L'chol Echad Ve'Echad. And if it's only a matter of Mahadrin, so then the immediacy and the eating problem are virtually eliminated. This is the view of the Maharshal, I believe, and others who say that a person fulfills the obligation of Chanukah by being a member of the household, and it's not within your power to say, I don't want to be Yotze. That's where the Mishnah Berurah quotes, Tavshin Ayin Zayin, according to the opinion of Maharshal and others, that it's Lav Kol Kamina. You can't say, I'm not going to be Yotze in my wife's wedding. It doesn't work that way. Because Mrs. Chanukah, their issue beso, there's only one per couple, issue beso is one, and you can't say, I don't want to be Yotze my wife's place. Why not? How is it different than Kiddush? So the Birkei Yosef explains, Kiddush is a chovas gavra. The person does not want to fulfill the mitzvah with Kiddush, or with a bracha on Sfiras Omer, or on Hallel, as is commonly done. That's your prerogative. But a chovas habayis, as long as you're a member of the household, whether you like it or not, you fulfill the mitzvah. And therefore, it seems to me that they have fulfilled the mitzvah if their father lived for them. It's only a matter of
Hello? Rebbe? Uh-oh. Rebbe, just bear with us a minute. Let's see if Rebbe gets back on. I'm going to unmute everybody until we see what happens. Rebbe, are you there? I don't know what happened.
I'm back. My phone went off. I apologize. I'm back. I hope everyone hears me now.
Yeah,
the last thing I think I said was that in question number 17, having someone lie for you is a possibility, but I don't think it's appropriate in this particular case. So that's why I think they should lie when they get home. 18. In my local day school, in an attempt to boost staff morale, the administration wants to have a game of Mystery Maccabee for the entire faculty, Rebbeim and secular staff. This means that every staff member is to randomly pick a name of a fellow staff member and give them an anonymous gift, only to reveal themselves later at a staff Hanukkah luncheon. Some of the Rebbeim are uncomfortable with issues such as lo sechonim, giving or receiving a gift from a woman, and that this entire enterprise smacks of imitating Secret Santa. Should this be allowed? There's no lo sechonim here, in my opinion. Lo sechonim is a gift which is given to a nachri when there's no benefit, no gain. Here, obviously, if they're going to boost the staff morale, there is gain, and it's good to have a proper secular staff, Yehudim or nachrim, either way. You want the school to have a good secular staff. I don't believe lo sechonim is a problem at all. As far as giving or receiving from a woman, in this circumstance, I don't believe it's a problem either. The biggest problem, of course, is this Secret Santa. If it's Secret Santa, that's a serious problem. Chukas Akam, at the very least, it could be even Abbas Rida Avodah Zarah, because even though Santa has become de-Christianized to some extent, became only a folk religion, but still, it's obviously not ours, and it's certainly inappropriate for a yeshiva to do something which is imitating Secret Santa. Not that I ever heard of Secret Santa before, but someone thinks it smacks of that. Don't know enough about the details of Secret Santa. But if there's any kind of objection of this nature, I think it should not be done. And should find a different way to boost the staff morale. You don't want to boost the staff morale over the objections of some of the mechanchim, the rebbeim, for whom the morale will be lowered, not boosted. Finally, 19. Just please discuss purchasing coffee from a non-Jewish store, such as Dunkin' Donuts or Starbucks. What is the basis of purchasing a cup of coffee in a non-kosher store where this treif is also served? Even when we are certain the coffee beans are certified kosher, why are we not concerned with A, Bishul Akam, B, for kalim that are washed clean with actual non-kosher items, C, for Maris Ayin, purchasing or sitting in these stores where non-kosher is being served. D, artisanal coffee such as lattes, cappuccinos, where milk is heated and frothed, would that have an issue of Bishul Akam? So A and D are the easiest ones to solve. We pass in La'alocha and Hilchos Bishul Akam, Yerodea, Simon, Kuf, Yud, Gimel, that coffee is not a problem of Bishul Akam, because the main ingredient of coffee is water, and water can be consumed in a raw state. The same is true of milk, and therefore there's no Bishul Akam problem whatsoever. The bigger problem is the kalim. That's a significant problem, and I refer you all to the beautiful article by the CRC, which was written by Rabbi Fishbein and Rabbi Cohen, Shlita, some years back. about Starbucks in particular, and I think similar for other types such as Dunkin' Donuts, I believe, there is an issue of kalim being washed clean with non-kosher items. That is a significant issue. But they report if you're having plain coffee, and that's all you're allowed to buy there is plain coffee, because otherwise you got flavors which are major problems. Plain coffee, the way it's brewed, the way it's described, there is not a major problem. Most of the kalim are washed individually. It was soap involved. And moreover, the claim is made that even if there is some non-kosher aspect to the particular kli that brews the coffee, the way it's described there, it's not a kli rishon, it's only a kli sheni. It's described as the hot water comes and lands on the coffee grinds and on the paper and trickles down into the particular utensil, the brewer, so it would not be considered to be a kli rishon, but a kli sheni. What I assume they mean is it's called an irui shenifsak hakiluach, that if you pour the hot water and it hits the grinds first, then it sort of moves around, and then it drips, drip at a time one drop at a time into the kli. That's called nifsak hakiluach. Nifsak hakiluach, according to most authorities, there's no absorption whatsoever. If there is any, it's only what we call a kadei klipa, a small amount, which is batel b'shishim, so the coffee would be kosher. It's very important to emphasize, it's only permissible if you're using a styrofoam cup, a disposable cup, because the cups that they have are potentially have contained treif themselves, at least washed with treif, and therefore you should not use a cup for hot coffee. I do not believe it's any maris ayin, because it's well known today that donuts and Starbucks, people go in there just to drink coffee and not to have anything non-kosher, and if it's well known, there is no problem of maris ayin. Thank you very much, and I'm sorry for the interruption.
Thank you, Rebbe. We hope we can call upon you again, hopefully even before Hanukkah Mitzvah Hashem. Take care. Thank you very much. Take care.
Bye-bye.